Okay, Love, go ahead.
We're going to be talking to Henry Lovejoy and Lisa Lovejoy about their several lines of products, which we've been enjoying enormously, I might say, you too. I have Echo Fish, Frochet, and Henry and Lisa's natural seafood. Now we've had Echo Fish and Frochet. How is it differentiated from the natural seafood line?
So we have two different, and actually, just to start out, it's called, we pronounce it Ecofish. So
Oh, okay.
as opposed to echo, but so Ecofish.
It's one of those words, people just pronounce it differently.
So we started Ecofish in 1999, and our first line of retail products that we started with was Henry and Lisa's Natural Seafood. And those are, the canned line is primarily just protein. So there was tuna, sardines, and salmon from Alaska. And then we have a line of frozen items as well under Henry and Lisa's. And that is fish nuggets, salmon, and burgers. And then a few years ago in 2018, we launched a new line, and that's Freshay. And Freshay is just an innovative line of tin small meals produced in Portugal. When we were traveling through Portugal looking for sardines, we met these people at this wonderful cannery, and together we worked to produce these really innovative, neat small meals in a tin.
Yeah, I mean they're wonderful. They're really good, but all of it was very good. How did you get to the specialty food business? I mean, where did you come from?
Hank?
The story goes way back 25 years. It's amazing to think that we started way back in 1999 when the term sustainable seafood wasn't even coined at the time. We've been selling live lobster from New England throughout Europe and Asia and got to know the global seafood industry and really felt like it needed a solution as far as the environment and sustainability and overfishing. And incorporated the company Ecofish Inc. in 1999 to help deal with that. And originally started actually FedExing fresh seafood to celebrity chefs around the country. The celebrity chefs at the time were really the spokespeople of the new sustainable seafood movement. So it was a great way to get started, a great way to build up a little bit of money to launch our retail products that Lisa just described, Henry and Lisa's Natural Seafood in 2006 and Freshay in 2018.
Yeah, well, somebody sent us from the Lobster Council. I forget, I can't remember the name of the shop. Live lobsters, and I did not know how these lobsters were going to survive the shipping, But I opened the box and they waved at me. It
Yeah, it's amazing. They can be really hardy. We always look for the ones with hard shells, and we pack them up really well with gel ice packs and insulated boxes, and they travel quite well. But definitely one of the most perishable products on earth. So there were plenty of sleepless nights in that business.
Oh, yeah. Now, do you still ship live lobsters?
We do not. We changed to Ecofish in 1999.
We have we have a tradition in our family that at the time you're 5, you have to be able to handle on your own a whole life a whole lobster.
Oh, wow. There's
So
an art to that.
Oh, yeah. But, in fact, I was a little worried because our son used to go to a seafood store that kept live lobsters in a tank, and he used to play with them. So I was afraid he wasn't going to be able to do this. But it turns out that it came with, he was 5, and it came with a placemat that had instructions on how to deal with the whole lobster. And he was so proud of being able to read, he got distracted from the fact that it was, and so it went well.
Lisa grew up on the West Coast, and their version is obviously Dungeness crab. And
they
had a similar tradition in their family. We were at a family reunion many years ago, and it was fun. They taught me how to eat West Coast crab.
Well, you know, what are the big fat crab legs? I've got them for one of our kids, and who figured out that if you got a hold of one of these legs and blew on it, it sent the meat across the room.
I want to have dinner with your family.
always a treat. What did you do before you started with seafood?
I was a greenhorn straight out of college. I was young and naive and announced to my family I was going to start an export trading company straight out of college. And the funny thing is, you know, this definitely dates me because there was no internet back then. I went to the Boston Public Library and they published trade leads every day for people in other countries looking for products from the U.S. And I wanted to do a product that was indigenous to New England and saw a lot of trade leads for lumber and lobster and decided to run with a lobster, and the rest is history.
Well, you know, I mean, my story is kind of a parallel story, except that I did it with opening a restaurant and not knowing anything about it. Two friends of mine and I, we went to the library and got books on it, you know. Of course, we read all about it, and the one thing that they didn't tell us in any of the books was, anybody who sets foot in your restaurant will try to steal from you. So anyhow, well, I learned my lesson early and didn't have to repeat that.
Now, you will, by the way, be successful.
Is it what?
The rubbers, by the way, turned out to be successful.
Yeah. Oh, that's awesome.
Tell me about, what sets, we've eaten a lot of tin fish lately, you know, because everybody seems to be making it, but there are definitely different levels of it. Everything from your standard old canned tuna to, the upscale stuff like yours, which I view as upscale product. What sets yours away from, separate from the others? What are your distinctions?
Lisa, would you like to take that?
Well, number one, our mission from the very beginning is to have only certified sustainable products. So our items are 100% sustainable, and so that means they each carry either the MSC or the ASC seal, which is a nonprofit that is certifying fisheries around the country. So number one, the thing that sets us apart from everyone is that you know when you buy any of our items that you're buying sustainable products. And obviously quality is our second greatest promise. And so we seek out the highest quality ingredients. We do our best to have everything processed locally near where it's caught or produced.
Great.
And that also creates a higher quality item. So I think those two things are the things that set us apart.
Now, you do a lot of business with Portugal.
We do. That's where our partner cannery is. And it's fun. A lot of people are traveling to Portugal and Spain now and discovering the quality of European tin fish. The cannery we work with has been in operation for 178 years and are literally the people that first put fish in a can. And their know-how and culture and history is just incredible. So it was really fun developing the fresh hay items because they're just so unique in general. You know, up to that point, canned fish was canned fish, and there was obviously better quality canned fish out there, but nobody had put a meal in a can before. So that was a really fun project for us. We worked with a celebrity chef, developed different trending global recipes, and paired them up with certified sustainable tuna or salmon, added vegetables and legumes, olive oil, spices, super healthy. They all mimic the Mediterranean diet. So lots of differentiators that make fresh hay really in Henry and Lisa. It's just the super premium quality of the fish that we work with.
The only complaint I had was, and I have this about everybody who has those tins with the pull tabs, mm-hmm. a lot of them come off in your hand, the pull tabs.
Generally, that is because they're not to be negative, but people actually aren't opening them properly.
Right. Well, so, I figured that was correct.
Yeah. Yeah. So basically, you just have to make sure you push that tab all the way back and then pull it forward. But I do every once in a while get messages from people, so I send them a little tip on how to open it, so hopefully that doesn't happen again.
Americans don't know is that there's a little divot if you look closely on the top of the lid for your thumb. That's the key. So when you, like Lisa said, you pull the tab backwards and then you put your thumb down on that tab right behind the pull tab. It's on that divot, and then they peel back really nicely. But without that knowledge, it can be kind of messy opening a tin of fish.
Yeah.
feels kind of risky.
I just ordered a new can opener because it was advertised as being able to open cans, open pull tab tins, and open jars, all of those. And
oh,
I haven't
wow.
got it yet, but I mean, I'll let you know if it works.
Yeah.
That sounds like quite a contraption.
Yeah, it sounds to me like it. And it wasn't very expensive either, so I'm not so sure. I don't have all my hope placed in that. Now, I mean, how many different kinds of products do you have? I mean, you have tons of stuff, don't you?
Yes. So we have six items in our Freshet line, and four of them have tuna base, and two of them are salmon. So, for example, one of the tunas is the Sicilian caponata. So, along with the tuna, there's butternut squash, fire roasted vegetables, almonds, and herbs. And
yeah, I like that one a lot, by the way.
That is really yummy.
I thought it was yummy. I didn't think it was really appropriately called caponata, though. But that's got my Sicilian background. but whatever it is, it sure was good. So what else do you have then?
Well, so we have in the salmon side, there's one that's called Moroccan tagine. And
yes,
you can find yummy salmon. Yeah, that's Henry's favorite. With chickpeas and onions, roasted zucchini, quinoa, olives, and lemon. It's really, really tasty. That one is so good.
It's amazing to me that you were able to find people overseas that could make these up. It took them out of their familiar territory in tin fish, right?
It was fun for us because
we
working with a chef here in the U.S., literally in his test kitchen stovetop with mason jars, got him the recipes to a point where we thought they were ready to go to Portugal, and we'd fly over to Portugal with the mason jars and start working in the lab of the cannery and scaling them up. So Yeah, it's a lot of fun, and the know-how over there is absolutely incredible.
Uh-huh. Well, I mean, the qualities. I don't know why it's taken so long for people to catch on to Portugal, by the way. Although I hear
we couldn't
it's
agree more.
Crowded. Hmm?
It is getting crowded, for
getting
sure.
Crowded.
We first went about 10 years ago seeking out sardines for the Henry and Lisa's line. And as Lisa said, we stumbled upon this cannery. We visited, I think, a dozen canneries in 10 days up and down the coast. And they were just starting to put some beans in with their sardines. And we tried that. And it was kind of our epiphany moment. And, you know, with the healthy snacking trend here in the U.S. and everybody wanting to get, you know, healthy protein on the go, we just thought that it really had a good place for the market.
Right. So, but you admit it's getting crowded.
Yeah, certain places. I think we drove 2,000 miles in that teeny country over that those 10 days, and we saw a lot of the countryside, too. And uh-huh. That certainly isn't crowded now. But, yeah, the main places that everybody goes are getting pretty crowded.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that part of the reason we don't spend more time there is I have trouble with the language. I mean, I know you don't have to speak the language of all the countries you go to, but I like to. And it's one of those things where if I read it, there's enough of other languages there, like Spanish, that I think I understand it. But once something comes out of somebody's mouth, I don't understand what they're saying. Although we have a great niece who's a translator and a linguistics person in general, and her big language is Portuguese. Yeah, she spent a lot of time there. Yeah, so okay, now we have people dying to get a hold of this product. I mean, how do you get it? What's its availability?
Henry?
You can find it in about 2,500 grocery stores nationwide. And anywhere from your beautiful corner natural food store right up through to, you know, the Whole Foods of the world, your regional supermarket. We also are available on Amazon, and very shortly will be available through our new website. And you can reach that at ecofish.com.
Ecofish.com. Okay.
Correct.
That's great. And you get all of the products on that. And you do you do e-commerce? You can order it then, huh?
You can. On Amazon, you can order Fresh A, and within about 2 months, you'll be able to get all of the Fresh A items and the Henry and Lisa's tins directly off of the EcoFish website.
Okay, that sounds great. What? Weren't you afraid of going into a market that suddenly was blooming with competition?
It's not easy out there. We'll be the first people to say that. It's getting increasingly more competitive and difficult. But I think, you know, as long as you have really high-quality products that are really well-differentiated, you know, you have your spot in the market.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, the price point issue is another one. Everybody's suddenly very wary of that costs for food.
Yeah, it's true. And you know, the interest in premium European tin fish, there's some new brands that have come out that think they can get $8 to $12 a tin for fish, which is fine. But the reality is you know, for $5, $6, you should be able to get that kind of quality. And that's what we try to do with our products. Just in general, tin fish is a really healthy and very cost-effective option for families as well. I've seen more and more recipes based on using tin fish. It's a really good entry point for families that are, you know, looking to have a high quality protein and not spend a ton of money.
Right. I mean, anybody who's concerned about cost should just look at their fresh fish store and see what the basic product costs.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, I remember buying fresh halibut. I think it was for the whole family. I think it was 3 pounds. And it was like, it was absolute sticker shock when I got the price tag on that.
I think I was the one who said, sweetheart, you must be nuts.
Halibut is expensive. Have you guys ever tried black cod from Alaska, sablefish?
Yeah, we had some this week.
Peter does a really good, he does black cod, like really a pro.
Dollar for dollar, it's I would reach for black cod every day over halibut.
Nobu, with his restaurant in New York and several around the world, probably has made the popularity of black cod even more so.
Yeah, and you
without question, that miso glaze is amazing.
Yeah, I think that's basically what that preparation Peter relies on. So,
I have to provide one piece of interesting information for our listeners about Portugal, and I'm guessing that probably know it already, but if not, then they're about to learn something very interesting, because the president of the country of Portugal was headed up for a number of years by the professor of geography at Lisbon University. His name was Salazar.
Isn't that interesting?
That was, and that's the bloodless revolution, right?
Something like that.
Yeah, not revolution. Yeah, it was bloodless revolution. I think they overthrew somebody's government in favor of him. And I don't know, our friend Tony would know, who's a Portuguese chef.
The history over there is just incredible, especially for us Americans, where we think, 300-400 years of history is a lot. Lisa and I we love castles. So when we went and did the sardine tour, we also visited as many castles as we could. And, the medieval history over there, and not to mention, I think it's, some of the best food in the world and some of the nicest people you ever meet.
Right. I remember I broke my foot in a castle in Italy.
Oh, no.
Stone stairs. There's somebody mentioned castle. I think of my broken
Ouch.
Foot. Everybody told me if I could walk on it, it was fine. I walked around for 3 days with a broken foot. It was not fun.
Oh, no. Ouch.
So I wish you continuing success. I have one last issue to address. Since you're into sustainability, I read all this doom and gloom about the oceans, and I'm scared. I mean, how close are we to overfishing everything and destroying our aquatic heritage?
Well, I think it's similar to what we've done on land. The difference is the ocean covers 72% of the planet, so hopefully there's more hope. But we started, overfishing the oceans probably starting 50 years ago. And the good news is we have organizations like the Marine Stewardship Council and Aquaculture Stewardship Council that are certifying fisheries and aquaculture worldwide as sustainable. And so really for consumers to, have that hope and know they're doing the right thing is to look for those labels on the seafood that they buy, and they'll see them in ours. And I think that's the best way to have hope and know that you're doing something that'll help.
They had that big international marine conference in France and some a few years ago, and with a goal of dealing with this subject, that overfishing and everything. And of course, the biggest tuna consumers in the world didn't show up, Japan.
Yep.
Well, yeah, it's true. I think that we're hopeful, and I think that if we all do our part, and agriculture plays a huge role in this as well, because about 4 or 5 years ago, agriculture production surpassed that of wild fish stocks, meaning that as the world population grows, we're not going to get any more wild fish out of the oceans, and we shouldn't. So aquaculture is starting to take up where wild can't provide. And you can do aquaculture sustainably, as any ASC-certified fishery will show you. Our fresh A salmon recipes are made from Norwegian-certified sustainable farm salmon.
Yeah.
So I think that's another, ray of hope.
We gravitated towards that, too. At first, I didn't want any part of it. And then, I realized how serious the issue was. And so we've gravitated towards that, too.
Yeah, and the farms have gotten so much better. 10 years ago, there were issues. And now they're doing a much better job with what they feed them and reducing the chemical use and those kinds of things.
Right. Well, it's been a delight talking to you two. Listeners, again, look for Eco Fish and Fresh A, and remember Henry and Lisa Lovejoy, and I hope you live up to your name.
It's been
thank
a lot of
very
fun.
Much.
Thank you so much.
Yeah,
thank you.
Thank you
too. Bye bye.
Take care.
Bye bye.
Yeah, bye bye.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Oh, listeners, I'm gonna be sloppy about this because Steve Sando is one of my great idols. Rancho Gordo, he just came out with a definitive bean book called The Bean Book. And I can't even remember how long I've been an admirer of yours, if not an acolyte, Steve Sando.
Oh, it's so sweet. I think we met probably in 2008 with my first book, with Chronicle, which I think that's when we first talked, and you always have such an interesting approach to it, too, and I think you do so many different kinds of food, like from fine dining to specialty ingredients, and I think it's a unique perspective, so we've always had a nice time.
Right. Well, I repeated to you my definitive bean story is the super centenarian in Sardinia when interviewed by what did he attribute his longevity to? And his one answer was beans.
Isn't that something? And now we're finding scientifically, I never promote health because I'm not qualified, but
all
the blue zones
either.
Where people have longevity, it's always beans are on the diet. It seems like beans, fermented food, and family are the three key ingredients. But
Of course, Americans traditionally did not eat a lot of beans. But I grew up in a Sicilian family, and we had beans all the time.
Was that on the East Coast?
Close.
Was that on the East Coast?
Yes.
Well, when I do farmers markets or did them, people from the East Coast actually were much better about beans, and usually it was because of the Italian or French influence. And people from the West Coast or the South had a bean thing, but people in the middle, like, why would I even cook beans? What? They were so confused. Now, that's changed, but in the beginning, you could always tell where someone was from by how they ate beans. So it's very cute.
Yeah. Well, of course, the English, Peter's English, of course, he eats them on toast.
Yes, but which I've had English friends laughing because the beans are grown in Canada. They're American you know, they're indigenous to the Americas, the beans, with tomatoes, which are also indigenous to the state. So it's the most English food, you know, that is really from everywhere else. So they're probably made in Israel or somewhere, who knows. But I have had people ask me for, I'd like a recipe for English beans on toast. It's like, well, let's go over to Italy and try that. That's actually a little easier to do, and I think tastes better. But yeah.
Hey, one of the things you have to realize is that beans are really central to the British diet in a way that you wouldn't ordinarily pick up, because there's a thing called the English breakfast, which is served in places throughout the world, but especially throughout my homeland, and always in a corner of your plate when you were having a full English were beans.
So
and
funny.
They looked a hell of a lot like Boston beans.
Yeah.
And my mother used to make them and put them on toast.
So funny.
Right.
Well, it's sustainable. I mean, it keeps you going. Yeah.
We were obviously poor people. You could tell that.
Well, and I think that's the interesting thing, is beans really were marketed for poor people for so many years.
Sure.
Or maybe hippies at a food co-op. And then when I started selling them, it was because, oh, these are incredible. They're really different, and they're not standard. And I think we've talked about it. I was lucky at a farmer's market. Thomas Keller from French Laundry came up.
Yeah.
And he fell in love with them. And this was before the influencer thing, and I thought, oh, but this is how I'm going to do this, because I'm going to actually go after chefs and let them tell their friends. And that's really how we got started.
That's how you did it. I have something clearly off the chart here, is why are they so beautiful? That's something that's bugged me for a long time.
Well, I have a theory, because when they're growing, they look just like green beans or string beans. So it's a green pod, and the seeds inside are white. And then when it's time to harvest, we cut the plant at the base and let it dry in the sun, and it starts to die. And the pods go from green to tan, but the beans go from white to these wild colors. And I think it's nature's way of saying that you should save me because I'm pretty. And it's worked for me.
Oh, God, that's cute. Yeah.
But it does change, not until they're about to die. So I think it's like one last thing. Like, I'm attractive. Come on. Take me. Save me for next year.
Yeah. Well, you know, what were the beans that my mother grew all the time? They were so beautiful. But when you cook them, they become green again.
Yes. That's sort of nature's joke, is, you know, it's like getting married. They're all tarted up for the ceremony, and then once they're yours, they're a little more average looking. So it's not forever, that glamour part.
What was the name of the town in Umbria where you said all the students used to go? I'm trying to remember. It was Lago something or other, but I can't remember.
Oh, right. I don't remember either. And that's where the special beans grew.
Yeah, it's a big lake, and it's surrounded by many, many, many pots filled to the brim with the most elegantly colored beans. Mm. And I can't remember their name, and I can't remember the place where they grow, but I remember it made a great impression on me.
Right. Well, and that's the thing. People all think, oh, beans in Italy are from Tuscany and the Mangia Fagioli, but all over Italy they love beans. It's a myth that it's only in Tuscany. And some of the best are from the south, so Umbria would make total sense.
Yeah. Now, you've broken... Tell our listeners, I mean, we've talked about this before, your great epiphany. You did a whole bunch of other things before you got to beans.
Yeah.
Tell our listeners about your epiphany moment with beans.
Well, I'd done a million different jobs, and I'd actually thought, you know what, forget it, it's not going to work. So I get a garden and a job at a big box store is really what I thought. I was 40 years old, and I'd done a lot of different things. So I started gardening, and luckily never had to go to the big box store, because I started doing so well that I was selling them. But then I remember eating a bean called Rio Zape, and there was a hint of chocolate, a hint of coffee, but it definitely was pinto-like. And I'm thinking, how is it we know every obscure Italian village and winery in France as well, and yet these beans are indigenous to the Americas, and we don't even know what they are? And I thought, you know what, this is, I will call myself successful when the average American home cook says, oh, Rio Zape, I think I'll make so-and-so because I love them so much. So I've still got a ways to go, but it did dawn on me, this is our own food, and we should be a little more patriotic about it. And it's also nice because we share the bean culture with all of the Americas. And, you know, I'm a little pie in the sky, but that's my hope if we get there. But that's. I don't want to do health and I don't want to do sustainable green. And both of those things are true for beans. I really thought I'm going to focus on flavor because that really is what makes them unique and what people don't think about.
Yeah. You address this issue of saying you start with a pot of beans and don't add any aromatics or anything like that, so you can actually taste the beans.
Sure.
Which is a very good approach to it. It's sort of like, I remember I did a chili tasting and with, what's her name from Topo Lavamba, in Chicago. Anyhow, she said, describe the taste of the chili. Don't mention heat. And so you had to focus on the flavor of the product. And, you know, if you do that with beans, you might get a similar result. You get to do it. Yeah. Do you think it's true?
23 years. Yeah, no, I think so. And it's been 23 years now that we've been in business, and I really think beans were penance for people for being poor or for being needing to be healthy, and now they're this creamy indulgence, and I think that it's because you're tasting the bean. And a lot of times I would work with health departments in the beginning, and they had tons of these awful recipes really that would hide the beans in other food, or they'd say to make a simple pot of beans, just get a ham hock. And I'm not a vegetarian, but I think you should make them vegan so you can really taste what the beans taste like. They really don't need your help if they're heirlooms and if they're new crop. Now, if you were in Iowa and in a moderate grocery store and you picked up a dusty bag of beans, you know, maybe you do want a ham hock at that point. But, and there's a place for that. But I for me, let's buy new crop, which I would describe as being before 2 years old, and heirlooms, which just tend to have more interesting flavors and textures.
Yeah, a cousin of mine was briefly married to a Cuban, and he has his famous recipe, his family recipe, for black bean soup.
Yeah, and I bet it was good.
It made her so angry that any time anybody picked up the recipe and started to make it, they always added a ham hock, where it was set out it was supposed to be a vegetarian dish.
it's frustrating. And people will say, I did exactly what you said. I made them really simple. And then, like you say, they've added a ham hock or something. you still don't get it, but that's all right. But there is a place for commodity beans. Even though I'm somewhat of a snob, I totally get commodity beans are a really cheap form of fiber and protein, and they feed people, and they still can be great. So I think if you're cooking beans, you're ahead of the game no matter what.
Well, now, do you think you've covered all the varieties of beans? It's amazing how many kinds of beans there are, it seems to me.
No, not even close. I think someone once told me there are several hundred varieties, and within that there's probably thousands of little variations because the beans have adapted to the farmer. But no, I haven't even – that's the lucky part of my – I'll always be employed. I feel like I've barely scratched the surface of what's out there. But my joy is hunting for them. I mean, it's really fun. Between Europe and Mexico and all of South America, it's just – I think I've seen it all, and I was like, nope, here's something really amazing, and it's fun.
Well, do you have a hard time talking people into just growing Beans?
Yes, because, you know, the average grower now is getting older and wanting to retire, and his kids don't have the same romantic feelings that we do the beans often. So it is, we do, it's not for everybody, and you have to specialize in it. In the early days, we'd have each farmer grow, you know, 8 or 9 different varieties, and now we realize that you just want 1 or 2 so you can get really good at them, and then they make more money, and that's fine too. But it's a constant search to find different growers.
Well, yeah, I imagine so. And I mean, it's rather precise work, and there's a lot of downtime and waiting, and growing these.
Yeah. Well, yeah. But Jack and the Beanstalk is a true story in the sense that beans want to grow, and they want to grow big, and you really don't have to do that much work for the growing part. It's the harvesting that's the nightmare, and you need specialized equipment for that or
labor. Yeah, well,
labor.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was
but
thinking
they do want to grow.
Yeah. I still don't know why they have so many different forms and colors and all that.
Well, I think they adapt to where they are. So I was in Oaxaca, Mexico, and bought this beautiful gray runner bean that I'd never seen anywhere. And I've grown many beans on my property. This bean just went all year just growing and flowering and nothing really happening. And then around October, it just decided I'm going to produce. And it produced all the way into the following March. So it just – it clearly liked – our number of daylight hours, our level of heat, and I think I'm on a mountain, so maybe somewhat the altitude, who knows. But it's really interesting that they, you know, they adopt so that they can grow anywhere.
How do you organize your book? And let's start off by telling our listeners how many beans you cover, heirloom beans.
Well, in this book, we talk about 50. At any one time with Rancho Gordo, we have 25 to 30 varieties that we're either growing here in the States and we import probably 5 from Mexico. And mostly we grow on the West Coast, Central California. And in the book, we go into 50 different ones. But we have substitutions for them all, so you can do that. They approached us to do the book several years ago, even before COVID. And I thought, oh, I don't really want to do that. But then I thought, you know, someone else will, so I think I better. And I thought, we'll just do our greatest hits. That'll be fine. And then as we're writing it, it's like, oh, this is really going to be, I think, a good book. It's going to be my big book. And it went from being just sort of, oh, we'll just gather up our greatest hits, to a book that pretty much took 23 years to write. And in it, we go into the different varieties.
Yeah.
And I couldn't have written this when I first started out, even though I thought I knew everything. But that's the
hubris
of youth.
Didn't we all?
Yeah.
So, yeah. Now, the recipes. First of all, listeners, you have to know that you get eased into this by some really sound advice and simple directions, so you're not just tossed into the middle of the bean pot here.
We do talk about how maybe Sunday night you should cook a pot of beans every week. And if you live alone, maybe 1/2 pound. And then you have beans throughout the week. So if you did a dark bean, there's now, you know, 30 recipes that you can choose from different things to do with dark beans. And maybe one night you make beans and sausages. And the next night you throw a handful into a salad, and then the last night you're going to make a soup. But there's still just a little bit left. Maybe you puree that and make it a dip. So you get a strategy for your beans. But if you – the idea of cooking beans for a recipe is a little exhausting. But if you have beans and then you figure out the recipes, it's much nicer. And pretty much I would say there's white beans, medium beans, and really dark beans. And within each category, they can intermix pretty easily. They'll be a little different, but they'll all work.
Mm-hmm.
We like to make it more confusing.
I vaguely remember that Mark Bittman, sweetheart, who told us that exactly what you just did, that he would make a pot of beans at the weekend and then he would eat them for the rest of the week.
It
yeah.
could be.
Yeah. He could be listening to me. I don't know.
Oh, actually, it's funny now we come to mention it. Is he still around?
Oh, yeah.
He was.
He's still around. He just
around.
Updated. his,
yeah, he's back.
How to
he's...
cook everything for kids now. He did a kid's
book. Yeah, that's the latest everything. One.
Yeah. No, he's very talented.
To what extent, Steve, are you like a seed bank for beans?
Well, there's a role for real seed banks. I feel the best way to save beans is to get people to eat them, because then they get excited about them. And so,
yeah.
I'm not very scientific, or I'm not in that direction so much as I just think, let's keep people eating them, and we'll continue, and then they'll thrive. So a lot of obscure beans, some of them even on the brink of extinction, are doing really well because we're growing so many of them. But I do admire that work of seed banks. It's just that isn't quite what we do.
But you do generate a lot of beans.
Yes, yeah, no, quite a bit.
Then you kind of spread them out.
Yeah,
yes.
It seems to me that you're throwing your net wider, are you, or is it just my memory?
Well, people are discovering us more. We were on a show, CBS Sunday Morning, which I'm so embarrassed to say I'd never heard of. And I said, oh, I think this might be big. We should do a couple hundred extra gift boxes. We got 16,000 orders from that one show.
Kidding.
It was shocking. It just – so – and people hear about us in different ways. And I think because I am the corporation, I am the company, and I still do all the writing, and I have some help now with marketing, but mostly it's me, I think people feel like I'm still there – little secret that they've discovered, and they love talking about it.
Oh, right.
We don't, and I think that's an interesting form of marketing, but it's really based on me being cheap. But it works for us. So.
So you have all these beans, and you're going to put them in some kind of format. How did you determine how you're going to arrange all these recipes in this book? And also, did you create the recipes, or did you just add on to other recipes, or how did you approach the recipe part of it?
Well, they had a clear idea. We wanted to do the white, light, and dark beans and separate them that way, and they didn't want that. They really wanted a more traditional, these are appetizers, these are soups, which for me is hard.
They meaning the publishers.
Yes, Ten Speed Press, which is part of Random House. And to me, you know, my salad could be someone else's appetizer, or I would
right.
be happy eating it as the main course. So it's kind of hard, but that's what they wanted, and it's not that difficult. They wanted the section with the 50 beans described. So we have one section that's photographed after all the cooking stuff. And most
the photography is great, by the way.
It's really
hard to make black garbanzo hummus look good.
Yeah, no, but they're magic. They were magical. But we did have some conflicts, though, because the publisher wanted, if you look at the back of the book, there's sort of a nice-looking salad, and that's what they wanted on the cover. And I'm like, no, it's a bean book, and I know bean people, it's sort of fetishy, and we want – you know, beautiful beans on the cover. So I won that one. There were a couple I didn't win, but it's no. So the editors were somewhat strong, especially in the formatting. But Julia Newberry, my co-author, is actually the general manager here at Rancho Gordo, and she's been running our self-published cookbooks, because this is my eighth book, actually, because we just self-published them, because I've – not worried about James Beard Awards or anything, but it's just what would a bean freak like me be happy with. So those are the books I've been writing. And this was a little bit more broad. But Julia's a great home cook. So I'd say Julie and I wrote half of them, and then we had a lot of chef friends that I love showing off who also contributed. So, like, and some of the best are the chef ones. Like Stefan Terje, who was from Perbaco, in San Francisco, yeah. has this big white bean and mushroom stew that it's everything you love about a stew, but it turns out it's vegetarian, but it's just really to show off the Royal Corona, the big white bean, and beautiful mushrooms. And it's just the perfect winter dish, which is always appreciated.
I'm looking at this thing with the purple, the Chiapas-style ground beef cabbage and white beans. Mm. I mean, who could envision that? I mean, it's beautiful.
Well, and that was from a Diana Kennedy recipe, and it was sort of an obscure recipe in Mexico. She did it, but then I reinterpreted it with adding beans because it was just ground beans and cabbage. And so I thought, no, I'm going to add the beans to it. She was involved with us, and she was quite a character.
She's still alive. She is.
No, she died at 99, I think, about years ago. Yeah, but we did a party for her, and she said, I want you to do for chilies what you've done with beans. And I'm like, well, no, beans are kind of, they can go in any culture and any cuisine, but these chilies you want to use are real specific to Oaxaca. But I ended up being on the road with her for 2 weeks, and I have a book in me one day.
I bet she hasn't been a character. I mean, if you put what she did in that in her time frame, you have to wonder. I mean, you just have to wonder took.
Yes, I'm trying to be tactful. She was tough, but there's just no denying how great it was what she did for everybody, even for Mexicans, because I don't think a lot of people were documenting that kind of food in the same way in that era. So.
Yeah.
I always say hats off to her.
Well, this is a stupid question, but you've had a lifetime of beans now. I mean, did you learn anything new in writing this book? I think writing cookbooks is the most painful thing I've ever done in my life.
Well, that's why a team is happy, is a happy answer to that. Because, I mean, Julia, everybody helped me a lot. And then also we did all the recipe testing here at Rancho Gordo. I'm trying to think what I might have learned. I know, really, honestly. Well, I think a lot of stray thoughts in my head I had to put down on paper, and it was really fun looking at them. It was like, oh, and that's why I say these weren't just a collection of random recipes over the years. It really was a book that took 23 years to write. So I don't know that I think I've been writing the book for 23 years in my head. So, and it's nice putting it in perspective, is what I'd say, because we've been so busy, and I just haven't had a lot of time for a lot of reflection, which, you know, the unexamined life is not worth living. Well, that was mine. And I think it was nice to look as like almost like a victory lap, this book. It's like, oh, okay, we did a really great thing.
No, your market over all these years, your market has to have changed a lot.
It has, and it goes. It went from hardcore food people to, you know, I think during COVID, everybody was making beans and cooking sourdough bread, and I think we at least doubled, if not tripled, our sales during COVID, and they just stayed. So it wasn't a passing thing, and I think a lot of sourdough starters have died, but the bean love is still there. It is. And I think that's part of why the book is doing well, is because I still market to hardcore bean people, and now everybody's trying to cook beans. And that's why an editor was great to make a book that everybody can enjoy. But it was important for me that I wouldn't dumb it down so that people who are really good cooks or really love beans already, I still wanted to be of value for them, because sometimes it's easy to go low.
Well, you have a lot of give a lot of breadth to people who want to do their own thing. I mean, I think of all these big controversies. There's always a controversy, like should you soak the beans or not soak the beans? And you deal with these. You give people a lot of latitude in how they choose to do it.
I didn't used to, though. I used to be really opinionated when I was younger. It's like, you must do it this way. And now I'm like, oh, my God, you're cooking beans, good for you. And if that's the way you want to do it, I wouldn't necessarily soak. I will just say the only time in customer service when people say, I tried cooking your beans, but they never cooked, we say, how long did you soak them? And they said, a whole 24 hours, and they still didn't cook. And our beans are so fresh that the beans starting to sprout. So it's tightening up, and it will never get soft. So,
really? That's interesting.
Yeah. Almost to a time. So Harold McGee on Food and Cooking, I think it's called, the food science book, he says it's 4 to 6 hours all the hydration happens, and anything over that is extra. He also
says that.
Yeah. And he also says that you shouldn't change. Well, if you change the water, because some people believe that helps with digestion, he says you're potentially throwing out minerals and flavor, and that, you know, the effect of it is so minimal on your digestion that it's really not worth it. But you meet an old Italian grandmother, she's going to soak and she's going to change the water, and she's going to make great beans. So I think you really have to find your own groove, and as long as you're cooking. I mean, the thing I'm not into are canned beans, because the fact that you have to rinse them in order to make them edible, it means that something's going down the sink. They're too salty. They actually cook in the can.
Yeah, the salt is a big issue. I don't know if people understand that. I mean, it's like I'm talking to people who were carrying extra water weight because of pregnancy and so forth, and what they do is they have canned asparagus. Well, you're getting more than sodium. I mean, in that than you ever would with any other normal preparation. I enjoyed some of your variations, like adding beans to eggs in purgatory. I thought that was very humorous.
Oh, so delicious. Yeah. No, but they go everywhere, so it's kind of funny. And the nice thing is, you know, going back to the cooking as opposed to canned, you get free soup when you make your beans. So when you buy canned, you rinse it, and also the yield is completely different can to can. Like some of them, you get a cup and a half, and some of them barely a cup. But when you, the liquid you cook the beans in is you could. It's a perfect way to start soup. It's a perfect way to cook rice. I poach eggs in it. It's just a gift you get, and you just don't get that from a can.
Right. My mother used to poach eggs in the asparagus soup a lot.
Mm. Oh, that sounds
great.
That
would work with your.
That sounds great. I would do that in a heartbeat.
It really was. And here you have beans with your asparagus. You could do asparagus bean soup and poach eggs in it. Put that down. We'll do that for next cookbook.
The next book. Yeah, it's going to be in the next book. That's funny.
So now that you've done this for 25 years, is it 25 years?
23.
23
years, almost. I'm only 30. I don't understand how that works, but math is hard. No.
So, I mean, do you find it hard getting excited about anything else?
No, I tend to go narrow and deep. If something's of interest to me, I really go nuts. So I have a huge collection of Mexican movie posters. There's a silver designer named William Spratling from the 30s and 40s who I collect. I mean, I'm insane. I get very excited by lots of things. And still beans. That's the funny thing. I'll get a new variety of beans. Or someone else will make
your logo. She's wonderful, the woman in your logo.
Yeah. It's so funny. Yeah. No, but someone else will make me beans. I mean, I love my own cooking, but when someone else does it and it's something I wouldn't do, that is my happiest thing. It's like, good for you for thinking of this. That's a good thing. So, and that happens a lot.
You mean people actually make you cook beans for you?
Yeah, no, for sure.
Wow, what brazen of them!
No, I'm a snob about some things, but I love home cooking. That's I think the highest thing for me.
Well. I must say, you've established a niche that I never even knew existed in the culinary world, Steve Sando. And,
thank you very much.
Thanks also to Julia, she did a good job.
No, she's great. No.
Yeah. And it's very simply called, there's the Bean Book, 100 Recipes for cooking with all kinds of beans. And I can't get over just the physical appearance of how beautiful beans are.
Yeah,
and I would like to make my Christmas beans not turn all green when I cook them.
well, you're bean people. I can.
Are we going to keep the secret as to where you can buy Steve's beans?
No, let's do that.
Well,
do that.
Most of our beans we do direct to consumer from our website at ranchogordo.com. But we are in a lot of stores now. We don't use a national distributor, but we carry our own account. So we tend to be in she shops and butchers in particular, but a lot of specialty food stores have us too. But if you are in Northern California, we'd love to see you at our Napa store as well.
And you've started doing more collaborations too.
Well, I love promoting fellow entrepreneurs. So if there's any way we can help each other, I'm always keen on that.
Yeah, well, you're an inspiration to a lot of entrepreneurs, I must say. Who would have thought there was an empire of beans up there?
And a reminder to your listeners, I started at 40 doing this. So you can reinvent yourself at any time and maybe find success. So, you know, I remember being young and just tortured about what's going to happen. Oh, this isn't working. But all those things that tortured you actually gave you the tools to be successful at some point. So keep on eating beans.
Point well taken. Very good point to make.
Steve,
okay.
I saw something the other day. I don't know whether it will encourage you or discourage you, but I read somewhere that Campbell's was getting out of the soup business altogether.
I did hear that. Well, I heard they're changing their name, and they're not going to make any soup. I don't know, huh? I'm not really their customer, so I don't. I mean, the best to everyone. I hope that all works out.
I think they're rebranding is what they're doing, basically.
But if you ever thought about it, you'd find it very encouraging to know that you still were keeping the faith, as it were.
Right, right. No, but I hope we didn't put them out of business, but I kind of doubt it. But it's kind of wild.
Steve Sando, as always, great talking to you, and good luck, much success with your book, the Bean Book, listeners. It's definitive bean cooking, period. I don't think
Thank
I need
you.
To even say any more than that. Okay, Steve Sando, thank you
All
very
right,
much
well,
for talking to us.
Oh, we'll talk to you soon, I hope.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.